Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all these skills to address the subjects that we grapple with in this conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. Well, happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday,
even
Tyler.
Even though it feels a little bit like a Monday, right? Especially for you with your Monday class schedule.
Yes, but I know that I am here in the chair, so it must be Tuesday, and I'm happy to be here.
Well, great. Well, what are we up to today? What's on your mind?
Well, today I have a guest in the studio, which is always nice to have a partner to sit in here and chat with. So I'm excited to see where our conversation goes. And it's all kind of wrapped around this idea of how quickly the world has changed since the early 21st century, because it's 2020, so we're 20 years into this 21st century, and how quickly things have continued to change, and environmentally, socially, politically, in all aspects, the world continues to change. But also in the same time period, we've all changed and grown. And
I feel like I've changed and grown since just the beginning of this year.
So. There you go. That we're always in the process of evolving in some way. And so kind of the question for me, the overarching idea for today was, the world has changed, but how much has the world changed, and how much has the lens through which we view the world actually changed? Because if both things are happening simultaneously, how do we really perceive what change has occurred? And that might sound way more lofty than I was really intending it to be. But my guest, Chris Burkhart, is an award-winning photographer, artist, author, filmmaker, adventurer, world traveler. He also happens to be married to one of our favorite guests, Brianne Burkhart, who comes in often and chats with us. We talked about anxiety and horses a few weeks ago. So he's lucky enough to also be married to Brianne. But Chris has had this incredible adventure for the last decade plus of his life, starting off as a surf photographer and going out right out of high school and traveling California and creating the California Surf Project book. And that led to work with Surfline and Surfer Magazine and positions with Patagonia. And then the speed of his life ramps up, and all of a sudden he's, you know, writing books and working on documentaries and continuing to travel around the world and making a name for himself as someone who goes into these cold places, surfing cold places that other people have never discovered, which leads to a TED Talk in 2015, and then ramps up more with opportunities to go on speaking tours around the world. Chris's life has been in fast forward motion since the beginning of the 21st century. And along the way, he also got married to Brianne and has two sons. And today we're in the studio talking about kind of that 10-year trajectory of Chris's life, but also how he's changed in this time and how his lens through which he views the world and the things that he values and the things that are important to him have changed over the last decade. So today we're going to dive into our conversation with Chris, a little bit of background about how he got started on this quest. I don't know if you call it a quest. And where he sees himself going in the next part of this century. And also about a fundraising event that Chris is, the star of to raise money for his son's school, the Classical Academy, the Slow Classical Academy. So we're going to also talk about that. And we also will open up the phone lines at some point. If you have questions or comments you'd like to ask Chris, we'll invite you in. Our number is 805-781-3875. I am Elizabeth Barrett. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And you can be part of the conversation in numerous ways. You can call in and ask your question or make your comment. You can also send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can join us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or follow us on Instagram, elizabeth_TRT, and leave messages there, ask questions. You can see photos and get a nice picture of Chris and his sons up on Instagram today. And you can also listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org. We have 10 years of shows for you to listen to. And if you'd like to have the shows uploaded to your device to listen at your convenience, please check us out on Apple Podcasts or however you find your podcasts. Search A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, and the show will be there for you to listen to. So I am excited to see where the journey takes us today. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio KCBX. We'll be back in a moment to start our conversation.
Dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas.
I just get tired listening to that list of places. You're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and welcome Chris Burkhart to the show. So this is our third time.
Is it in here?
Yes.
Really?
I know. Over the course of
I thought it was only the second time.
That's the third time. Well, because when we recorded at your studio, and then we did one here,
yeah,
so it's our
yeah,
third time.
Yeah. So I'm in the archives.
Yes, you are. You're in the archives. If people want to hear previous shows with Chris, just Google his name and it'll pop up.
Well, everything I'm going to say today is probably contradictory to what I probably said back then. So,
which makes the whole point of the show perfect, because
yeah,
we hope that
great.
We grow and change in ways that we wouldn't recognize or maybe be a little embarrassed by.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of embarrassment, that's for sure. Yeah.
Because you're 33 now.
I am. I'll be 34 in about a month and a half.
So the That's hubris crazy. Of your 20s always comes back to haunt you at some point.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, what was I doing this time 10 years ago, right? I didn't have my first son yet. You know, I was 2 years into being married, and I was definitely trying to figure things out. It was pretty much like being in the deep end of a pool, not knowing how to swim. So I think that's kind of what it was like. And
but also feeling confident you would swim really well, because you always had a sense.
Yeah, I think that there was, you know, my early 20s were a really confusing time, like for anybody else. But there was, I think, one aspect of that time period that made it feel, that gave me a sense of clarity, being that I had found the person that I cared the most about in the world, and I married that person, and I'm only saying that because of the fact that I think that by doing so, you're able to allow yourself time and energy to focus on other things that are important. I mean, imagine how many people at that age are, like, you know, spending time on online dating apps and chasing around, you know, girls or guys and this and that. And for me, it was like, no, my career now is the thing. And so I don't really think I started my career at a really young age. I just think that I focused on my career at a younger time period because I didn't have a lot of other extra things to be concerned with. You
right.
Know?
There wasn't a lot of shiny objects other than the object.
Yeah. It was
you.
Like, this is it. Like, okay, I know who I'm with, and that is now established. Now it's time to become a provider or figure out what that means, I guess. And I think that oftentimes there are a lot of people out there who put off the idea of, you know, solidifying a relationship, or they just can't commit for a really long time, or they never do. And that is I'm not here. We don't need to dive into this right away,
we're 2 minutes into it.
But it's a complicated thing nowadays where this failure to find commitment in people's lives is rampant through everything you do, relationships and jobs and all that, you know what I mean? And that's kind of, I think, a scary scenario to be in. I just don't operate that way, so I can't relate in many ways.
Because it wasn't your trajectory. But interestingly,
I wasn't looking for relationships that were going to hopefully be something that were going to be here and gone. I was looking for somebody that I could, like, care about and join me on this journey. And I don't think that that's most people's prerogative right now.
Well, I don't think it's something that we teach or we emphasize.
No.
And you came, you know, from an interesting background because you were raised by a single mom.
Right, exactly.
And so having that stability, that family, having that person was really important to you, I think.
Oh, 100%. Her example of what she would seek out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, relationships for her were all about, okay, what can provide stability? And mm-hmm. So I was looking for a similar thing. And I think that's why I married your favorite guest, Bea.
Yes, you did.
she's definitely like ironclad, you know, sort of thing. And I'm not going to lie, you know, she can lose her sometimes. That happens. Sorry, I'm not allowed to say that, but she definitely can. But it is amazing how introspective somebody like that can be, and how we tend to work through things in a similar way. We're like, you know, we let it fester, then we analyze it, and then we become better people because of it. And that's what you want in a partner.
But you can't know that at 21. No, at 21, no. You were going on a gut instinct.
Oh, it was all emotion.
All emotion.
It's all fire.
But something was intelligent below the surface. Like something was innately wise. And I also think it's interesting because Brianne lost her father right after you got married. Right before you got married. And he was hard on you.
Like, yeah, I mean, he was
a little skeptical about your...
He was... The reality is, like, he was a... Yeah, you know, what can you say about, you know, trying to impress your father-in-law? But in many ways, he had an expectation that he wanted me to live up to. And in many ways, that was exactly what I needed, because I didn't really have a lot of other people in my life at that time besides my mom and my stepdad, but they were busy raising other kids, you know? And so I think that Roger stepped in and was an exemplar of what I needed in my life, which was like, hey, you know, if I'm going to, you know, give you my permission, not that we really needed it, but if I'm going to give you my blessing to take my pride and joy, like, I want to know that you're going to take care of her as much as I did, which he lived his whole life as an example of I think what a good supportive dad should be. And you knew him. So it's kind of a crazy thing to think about. And I you know, part of me definitely felt immense sadness for never allowing him to see, I think, the magnitude in which, you know, my career blossomed into, and and that I was able to provide for Bree and our two sons and whatnot. But that was a huge driving force as well. So,
and I think I like to set that stage, because I think a lot of people, if they just saw you from your Instagram account or your social media, see this kind of golden boy, you know, good looking, charming, good storyteller. But I think to understand you in context, because some things fell into place in perfect ways, synchronistic ways. Again, your background and your mom giving you this great role model of what was important and what to value, and then meeting Bree, and then having Roger be such a good role model as well. Like, these things kind of fell into place that in some ways freed you, gave you that stability in which to launch your career. Because had you not had the model that you did, but still had the desire, you say, in, you know, when we've talked in the past, kind of this wanderlust in the classroom, looking out the window, thinking, what's out there, what's out there, what's out there?
Yeah.
Had you not had the kind of that stability of your parents and Bree and Roger, how different would that trajectory have been if you'd taken off with the camera on your back to check out the California Surf Project? Mm-hmm. How might that have been a different experience?
You know, hindsight's 2020. You have no clue, right? Perspective is
everything.
We're in
2020.
So I have no idea how things might have been different. That's all I know is what I've my experience has given me, which has been the fact that if you want anything, you have to be able to work for it in some capacity and sacrifice something else. And so for me, in those formative years, I gave up a lot of pretty significant and important probably relationships and friendships. And I would say that I sacrificed maybe a bit more than I realized at the time. You know, we've talked about this, I think, in the past, maybe, I'm not sure, but that concept of the four burners and how your life is like a stovetop. And basically, if you want to find success, you have to turn one of those off. Those burners being family, friends, health, and work. Right? You have to turn one of them off. And if you want to be really successful, you have to turn two of them off. And I think that's the reality. So I absolutely decided to turn those down or off completely and let my career be the thriving aspect. And I think my relationship with my wife and my mom and my dad was still really, really important and paramount to me. But the reality is that I was a really bad friend to a lot of people. And that being just like, I didn't know how to be one, because I didn't, you know, cultivate those amazing relationships during the college formative years. I basically was living in the back of my car trying to make ends meet by like selling photos to the magazine, you know, one image at a time, you know, and that was that really gave me a great perspective on, I think, what it means to earn your way in this world. But what I would say is that all of those hardships, and I don't really in any capacity want to illustrate that my life was really challenging or hard, but all of the hardships that I faced early in my career they're in many ways eclipsed by the stuff that I knew my mom went through raising me and mm-hmm. what she was able to go through for me. And I do remember, you know, living on food stamps and being in a very like unstable environment. Mm-hmm. And just seeing that has given me such gratitude for those times, because I think you can never really fully comprehend how like good life can be unless you have experienced that in some way. And I look back at those harder moments throughout my career and I'm so grateful for them. In some ways I miss them immensely.
Well, yeah, because having the thing to work towards is a huge driving force.
Well, yeah.
Getting there is a little bit of a disappointment because the effort is in the desire, the hunger.
And where is the destination? I'm not even totally sure at this point. The reality is I'm trying to enjoy the process of getting to wherever it is I'm going as much as I can now more than ever, because for many years I was like, you know, put the blinders on, like head down into the wind, working on my career, working on doing anything I can to like, you know, make a name for myself, whatever it is. And pretty soon you come up for air and you're like, where am I? Like I passed through so many places that I wish I would have stopped and smelled the roses a little more, but
that's being in your 20s,
right?
Developmentally.
It is. And it's hard because I'm sure you can relate to this, but I grew up in a home where saying no to work was like, it might as well have been the 11th commandment.
Yeah.
Like you don't say no to work. Yeah. Like I watched my dad work, my stepdad, who is by all means my dad, he's amazing, amazing guy. I watched him just work his butt off. I'll save the language.
Thank you.
His butt off and just, you know, late into the night and everything. And that was the example that I had. And obviously my mom played a huge role in that as well. But understanding that like when jobs come and you finally are finding some success in your career, some foothold, right? Like you're not going to stop climbing the ladder, right? And you know, at a certain point you just think, oh, the view gets better. The higher you get, the view gets better. You're going to keep going up. Every job that comes, you're saying yes, yes, yes. And the problem with that is that when you're never taught to say no, you're constantly disrupting this idea that like when you say no, you're actually saying yes to what you want.
Back to the four burners. You're right. Making space for another one too.
You're making space. And so I was just filling up my time. And this concept of being busy is so scary, because the reality is being busy does not in any way attribute to being successful. Mm-hmm. Being busy just means you don't know how to manage your time. That's all it means. You've mismanaged your time to where the things you care about and the things you want most, you all of a sudden can't say yes to. You all of a sudden can't make time for it. And I have realized that there's been a lot of moments in my life where I've been a bit disappointed in the fact that I didn't make more time for something that was really important. And now I am.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Chris Burkhardt, award-winning photographer, author, documentary filmmaker, artist. I mean, your list is very long and impressive.
You can just shorten that and say I'm a dad.
And he's also a husband and a father to two sons. And we're here today kind of catching up on what life has been like for the last decade, but also want to talk about, you know, the values that you have now and the slowing down and smelling the roses. Mm-hmm. And part of that includes really tuning in with your sons.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one thing that's hard is like I really love this perspective that your career and life gives you and stuff like that. But when if there's a, you know, 20 something year old or a 16 or 17 year old out there, I wouldn't tell them to do anything different. I wouldn't say, exactly. Oh my gosh, stop and smell the roses. Like you'll eventually get there. No, you might not.
Right.
Like
there is a trade-off. You don't always get both.
Yeah. Well, the reality is like that time I put my head down and I just like worked as hard as I could. Like I still am now, just in different ways, more intelligent ways, smarter ways that I think are more harmonious with the life I'm trying to create.
Well, you have the, but you worked so hard that you got to a place that you get to make some choices. And I think that's important too.
Right.
That the sacrifices that you and Bree made
during
your 20s.
And I would say if people always ask, well, what was the, you know, Chris, what was the big turning point for you? What was the golden moment? And I usually tell people, I'm like, there was none. There wasn't a single golden moment. There was an overnight success that took 13 years. Mm-hmm. But the truth of the matter is that for every person in any career, especially ones that involve some creativity, if there is not a leap of faith, then it will, I just have found it will never, you will never find true success. And that for me, it comes down to kind of almost like a parable of sorts or analogy of being at a train track. And your bags are sitting there unpacked and you're shoving everything into this bag because this train is about to pass you by. And if you don't catch that train that's passing you by or the opportunity, whatever that might be, and you wait till everything's perfect and your bags are packed and everything's locked and whatnot, you're eventually going to be running down the tracks chasing that thing. And you're probably always just going to be out of reach. You're always just going to be like a hand away from like jumping onto the back. Or you're going to watch it go by entirely. Or you're going to say, hey, I might not be prepared. I might not be ready. This might be a complete leap of faith, but I'm just going to jump on. And you know what? If I leave my toothbrush at the station, I don't care. That's what it was like getting married at a young age. Mm-hmm. It was like, I have no clue how to make this work. But you know what? You become stronger by struggling through it together. And with my career, I worked at Esquire News in Pismo Beach. It was my last job I had for somebody else. It was a little magazine store that I was attending, that I was going to and working while I was going to Cuesta College. And quitting that job and quitting school were terrifying things because it was the very last piece of advice or very last thing that anybody wanted me to do. But I did it. And I forced myself to do it because I knew that there was an opportunity that was passing me by and I needed to jump at it. That's kind of, I feel like, what was important. But you asked something important about spending time with the kids, so I'm
sorry. Well, and also, no. Yeah. Because we have no direction. Okay, we're not really on a track.
Okay.
But I do want to make sure we talk about what brought you in. Today was the fundraising event that you have coming up on February 21st, because it's in support of your boys and their education.
It's in support of all the kids in the county. It's it's a charter school, Flow Classical Academy, that on February 21st, I'm doing a night of storytelling and showing a couple films, a film Under an Arctic Sky, which is about searching the ends of the earth for what I would call, you know, remote and sort of magical experiences that can only happen in nature. It sort of culminates in this experience of surfing under the Northern Lights. And it was a award-winning film that we produced in 2017. And then I'm going to be showing something new as well as doing a slideshow and doing a book signing for a new book that I came out with. It's kind of a whole kit and caboodle.
It's a Chris night. It's a Burkhard night.
Hopefully, there's also an amazing musician, a gal who's going to be singing to open up the night, and she's incredible. And we'll be really just raising money for Slow Classical Academy. And I think anybody who attends there and goes there knows that having options outside of just the public education platform is so awesome and important and something that we really advocate for. And really want to support other parents and people who want to do it. And this is what makes it so affordable, is by doing stuff like this. I mean, for me, it's a little uncomfortable because the last event they did is following up an astronaut who came and spoke. And that was way cooler than anything I'm going to be able to do. But I'm going to try my best. And I hope people can attend and they're interested in storytelling, because that's honestly the greatest gift that I feel I have to offer the world is sharing intimate experiences of what can happen out there at the edge of the earth and bringing those back. I feel in many ways like to not bring these experiences back to people you love, to your community, does the gift of traveling a disservice. Mm-hmm. It does it incredibly, it just limits your ability to really allow it to grow and expand within you and to share this concept of the fact that risk is ultimately and indistinguishably connected with what you can find out there is so important. And that's that, you know, bringing that back to this concept of raising kids, that is the probably single most important thing that my wife and I have tried to implement within our children, is the fact that we don't want to pass on an inherent fear of the unknown. Mm-hmm. Because I think that, as you know, and I've heard you speak about this really eloquently, is the fact that we all come to the table with all of our different karmic, you know, issues that we've had, and to sort of transfer those onto your children, can be just in many ways super scary.
Right. To give them the confidence to explore the world, you've done that by example, and then you provide them opportunities. And just to go back to the fundraiser, if people want to get tickets, how do they?
Oh, go to slowclassicalacademy.org or .com. I'm not sure. I think it's if you just Google it, it'll pop up. It's going to be at the PAC at Cal Poly, so it'll be on their events page. It's also on my website, chrisburkhard.com, or Instagram, or any of that stuff.
Social media land.
Social media land.
Well, as you're talking, I keep going back to the story of the hero's journey. You know, Joseph Camp talks about that a lot. And, you know, the whole experience you had of leaving home, being called to do something greater than, you know, what you were doing in you. And I've talked, as a kid, you were always looking out the window. There's something calling me. There's something calling me. And you got pulled out into the world and you, you know, went through your travails and your trials. And for a lot of people, they'd say, no travails. This guy shot surf photography for years and got paid for it. But, you know, in your own travails and trials and having to make your way and support a family. But the end of the hero's journey, you know, when we... And each of us has to go on a hero's journey in order to really come to our full self. But the end of the hero's journey that most people miss is that you never really become a hero until you go back and mentor another on their journey.
Interesting.
So all of our personal explorations, no matter what we've learned or experienced alone, really aren't a full hero's experience until we go back and we mentor the next generation. And that we take what we've learned and experienced back to our community, as you were saying, and share that, that we open the world and bring it forward. So it's interesting to hear you talk, you know, looking at our decade of knowing each other.
Yeah.
That that you're in this place now of turning backwards a bit and being that mentor for the next generation.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that I love nothing more besides storytelling than to help others tell their own. I would say that is critical to human growth and to understanding that if you want to tell better stories, you have to live them yourself. And I think that's been a big part of what I've sought out on the road is trying to cultivate more intimate experiences and be willing to share them, be willing to open your mouth. And a lot of times when I'm mentoring younger photographers and or anybody, whether it's through workshops or through one-on-one or this and that, it's a huge portion of that is just urging them to realize that a photograph is an incredibly powerful tool, but you and I could stand on the same vista in the same place and take the same photograph. I mean, me and you could easily. Mm-hmm. And you know, you might even take a better one. I don't in any way pride myself on being a better technical photographer. I pride myself on being someone who's willing to open my mouth and introspect into what that experience meant to me, into what and how I could be a better advocate for this landscape. And that's what I've done through a lot of my newer projects and books and films, is trying to speak and give a voice to wild places and our desire and need to protect them. I would say just as much as you're the reluctant therapist, I feel like I'm the reluctant environmentalist in many ways, because I want to use photography as a tool to share those places with mostly people that cannot go there. Because if there's one thing I've realized, is that you can speak till your nose bleeds to people in rural Africa or China about glaciers and the importance of them, but until they experience them and see them, they're not going to care. It's human nature not to care about something we don't experience. So how can you bring these experiences closer to people? And I guess I would just say to anybody who's ever tried to make a living, you know, as a freelance photographer in any capacity, don't quit your day job. Probably the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my entire life. And I respect anybody that does it, because you're basically working for scraps of scraps. And you are trying to like make it through. And I think that the big, big launching point for me was the realization that through doing films and books and bigger narrative projects, ones that really do combine a voice, not just like, hey, I'm going to go out and shoot these random images of these random people at this random place, but having like a goal in mind.
Yeah, context.
Yeah, for what these images could say or do or be, whether this is a big profile piece on a place or a person or a book that compromises a journey of the California coast, those are the things you become remembered for. And in many ways, those are the things that people understand, like, well, this person knows how to tell a story from beginning to end, from top to bottom. And that is so critical, right? Like that's been, I think, in many ways, the school of hard knocks that I've tried to enroll in some way.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Chris Burkhardt. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And we're kind of wandering all over the world with conversation today about Chris's...
That happens. My wife is a much more focused conversation.
That's right. I'm just enjoying the journey today. But we really don't have any goal more than to kind of talk about what's changed in the last decade since Chris kind of started this journey of his life and his marriage and his work. Our number is 805-781-3875. Live. If you have a question or comment for Chris, you can also find us on our Facebook page, Instagram, send me an email, listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. We are going to take a quick break and jump back in and continue our conversation with Chris Burkhard. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Tell you to run.
On the way. On the way.
And nobody say, nobody young. Well, pick me up with golden hand. On the sail. On the tell you to run.
On the way. On the way.
And nobody say, nobody young. Well,
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875. My guest is Chris Burkhard. Do I go through the whole thing again? Award-winning photographer.
Please don't. Please don't. Oh, my
gosh. I see your face turn red every time I start.
Nothing makes you more uncomfortable.
I know. And as soon as I'm just going to say a husband and father and friend and bike fanatic.
I mean, biking is such a silly thing.
It's not a silly thing, but people who follow you on Instagram, and I guess are you an Instagram influencer? You know, am I showing my age even saying these things? But but in some ways you built the monument of Chris through social media when other people weren't utilizing it.
I mean, yes and no. My career was in full swing. You know, I was...
Right, but no one else was really using social media. Well,
it's just,
time you were...
here's what it is. It's okay. Really simple. When I started, I think I was on my 8th trip to Iceland, you know, I've been there 41 times, for example. It was like on my 8th or 9th trip back in 2012 or 13 that I remember somebody being like, you should get on this platform, Instagram, you'd love it. And I was like, okay, I will. Back then, the concept of sharing images before the magazine could see them was absolutely no. You know,
you wouldn't give anything up.
You could never do that. But what I realized really quickly was that being able to share the behind the scenes, the moments leading up to these trips, these articles, these films that I was already doing.
The stuff you were packing.
This was my career.
Ate.
Yeah. People were interested in that. Yeah. And I found, wow, well, what an honest and rad way to bring people into the experience in a more intimate way, right? Mm-hmm. And allow them to comment and ask questions. But let's back up before that. I mean, I started shooting photos as a means to come back and share those experiences with my family.
Okay.
It was, you know, the fact that my mom sacrificed a lot for me to be able to do what I do. And I came back to give these experiences to her. I'd come back and do slideshows with my bodyboarder friends in the Central Coast and my family and my community. And nowadays, that's just grown to bigger, larger audiences. So it's still the same in many ways.
The essence of what drew you out
right.
there.
And I think some people are looking for, how do I gain, you know, followers? How do I get to millions of people? I'm like, I don't know. You know, there probably is some hashtag algorithm thing. For me, this is an extension of what I'm already doing. My work is not driven by the fact that I have a phone and can share photos on it. It's driven by the fact that as an artist, I want to tell stories. This is one platform that I love to do it on. And I've found that if you don't love to communicate, and you don't care about people, you will never find success in that platform.
Right. Don't chase something that you're not willing to kind of hand yourself over to.
I would envision for you, you'd probably tell another therapist in training, hey, if you don't like people, maybe don't do this. Because the reality is, this is just a glorified texting app. That's all it is. Yeah. That's it. That's what it is. Like,
but it goes back to, though, it's kind of this, I keep seeing this theme for you is things fell into place at the right time. You know, getting married.
I would never say that.
Yeah, I know you wouldn't, because you were working. You were doing the hard work. And I'm not saying it's luck. I'm just saying
fortune
it isn't.
Fortune favors the prepared. And I think that's the reality.
That you were doing the work and had something to offer.
If you don't create space for those things to go into your life, then they never will.
True.
So,
but you were open and available to all of these things. And I think
I was also available to failure. And I wasn't afraid of that. And I think that I've failed a lot. I mean, that's one massively important component is that being like for the amount of published projects and books and covers and this and that, do you know how many trips have gone awry? Do you know how many moments there's been spent in places that I never thought I would be, away from my family, like just really bummed out and feeling like I just ruined, you know, a trip or a year or a relationship or whatever. And that's a part of it.
And that's another key piece is that a lot of parents and a lot of people, we have such an intolerance for pain or disappointment or sadness for ourselves and for our children that you weren't hindered. Yeah, you haven't been hindered by this fear of failure. There was no pressure from your parents to be perfect or to get the perfect career or to go to the big college.
No.
They created space for you to kind of fumble and find your way.
They did.
Another gift.
They definitely were really bummed when I told them I was quitting school. I mean, think about it. Like the first kid in your family who could, you know, have a 4-year degree or had scholarships.
Right.
Took that scholarship money and basically spent it on cameras and financial aid, you know. But that's what I did. And I felt an even greater sense of I had to prove myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to make sure that there was this self-worth that was
But no one was running in to scoop you up or protect you. And I think that was key.
No.
So you had to keep getting up on your feet again because you'd made the stand. I'm going to take this route. And your parents were like, okay, good luck.
You're right.
Have a good time.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, creativity is something that we're all born with.
Agreed.
And for some of us, it kind of fizzles away and dies if you don't use it. It's like a muscle. And I would say that in many ways, it is one of the most healing, most incredibly beautiful things that we can do is to create something. And I felt like I couldn't live. I couldn't breathe without the idea that I wanted to be hired for what I was capable of creating with my hands or with my voice or with my
whatever.
Yeah, and that's changed over the years. I think I used to identify as I'm a photographer and this is what I do. And all of a sudden, you know, when we worked on the TED Talk together, when I spoke at the TED Global Conference in whatever, Vancouver, I realized, wow, my voice, my story, what I'm telling people can be as impactful as a tool to inspire than my photographs. That was such a validating experience. Mm-hmm. And it's taught me that, okay, I'm not just Chris Burgard, the photographer. I can also wear these other hats if I continue to flex them and train them. And it's been an eye-opening experience. Sure.
So let's get back to kind of the theme at the beginning about how the world has changed since you set out into the world at 21 and where it is at 33. You went to Iceland. How many times have you been?
I've been 41 times.
41 times. And now, you know, you can't look at an advertisement without someone saying, come to Iceland.
Okay. Of course, yeah.
So let's start with Iceland as you saw it when you first went 40 times ago.
It's so funny. It's amazing how a place can really change you. And I don't think I've ever been homesick for anyone or anything besides my mom and my dad, my wife and my kids until I went to Iceland.
Hmm.
It's been a decade of going there, over a decade. And the very first trip, I was there to tell a story for Men's Journal. I was there as a photographer documenting a surfer who had a staph infection and who could no longer surf in warm water. And his half of his brain had been removed. Long story short, that's why we were there.
Oh.
Every trip I've done there has been for a work trip of some capacity. Over the years, my relationship with the place has changed. I all of a sudden realized that I didn't want to be this person traveling to endless amounts of places, getting stamps in my passport over and over and over to places that I could never form a relationship with. So I don't want to be the guy who's been all over the world and
just selfies at all the big
spots. It's like
spots.
I want to go back to places, the ones that I care about. That's why I've been to Norway multiple times and Iceland and Alaska and the Faroes. And these are the places I care about. And to set roots there is in some way so much more valuable to me than the instant gratification and the high that we get from traveling. It was the people. It was the environmental initiatives that I all of a sudden fell in love with. And over the course of my career going there in the beginning, just to shoot surfing, just to shoot magazine assignments, to shoot brand campaigns, to direct Super Bowl TV spots for Toyota or whoever. I think we did something for Jeep back in the day and shoots for Apple. I realized that if you want to advocate for places that you really care about, you need to learn how to use your voice to do so. And it was like 6 or 7 years into that experience that I realized that there was that this beautiful landscape that I considered and many considered still to be the last great wilderness in all of Europe and the most powerful rivers in the world were all threatened to be dammed. very, very figuratively and literally, because of aluminum smelters that were poisoning the water, as well as dams to create cheap energy export. All of this could be at risk of being lost forever. The biggest dam in all of, or the biggest waterfall in all of Europe is now gone, and nobody will see it because it's in the East Fjords, and a lot of these smaller towns are being sold the concept that they can create new jobs and they don't have to rely upon the dying fishing industry or these other extractive industries. And then they go and they sign off on creating something and then the jobs aren't there. And so I've worked hand in hand closely with the government and the Icelandic Ministry of the Environment to advocate for these river systems and work to create a national park in the middle of the country. And that, I think, in many ways has been my greatest legacy there, is to help and support them. And I just came out with a new book called At Glacier's End, which is about the path water takes from the glacier to the ocean. It's not a book about climate change. If that's the way you perceive it, then you can take that away. But it's more
about... Is it a kid's book or is
it... No, it's a book about aerial photography of Iceland's beautiful, intricate river systems and how their relationship with extractive industries has been put on hold because of people like you and myself going there and showing them that people's interest, that our love for wilderness and our love for nature is more important and monetary and fiscally available and valuable than they ever thought. Basically, how tourism saved Iceland.
Which was going to be my next question.
Yeah,
you're okay with the amount of tourism that has taken over the country?
Absolutely. Iceland does not have a tourism problem whatsoever. It has a marketing problem. The problem is people go there and they spend the majority. Imagine going to California. It's this huge state. Iceland's a big island, right? It's massive. Imagine going to California and basically spending all your time in the Sierras. Mm-hmm. Imagine every single person who visited went there. That's what happens there. They all drive within a 6-hour stretch of the airport because that's what is marketed to them. These waterfalls, these locations, these tour buses that will do this one day trip. And so while one area of the country is being impacted really heavily, overly impacted, the rest of the country is suffering because they want and need the tourism dollars to support towns like Eglastadr and Drupavogur and all these like remote villages where they've converted their farmhouse into an Airbnb because of the promise of tourism, and then they don't come. Mm-hmm. So that's really the issue, and that's what we've been advocating for, is to protect the river systems so that they don't become dammed, and then as well as that start to help promoting tourism in other parts of the country so that people can understand that, you know, back in the day, that's not in any way
Are you aging me?
I'm not aging you, but I'm just saying back in the day, our parents and the people, you know, we sing songs about it. You know, Bob Dylan wrote songs about like driving down endless dirt roads just to see what's there. And nowadays we don't do that. We talk about it and maybe you post about it on social media because it sounds cool. But the reality is, no, you go to places with a checklist. And if that checklist is not sort of regimented and ticked off, then you feel like your trip was unsuccessful.
So like the New York Times listing the 52 must-see places, that makes a checklist.
Well,
then everyone...
going to a must-see place is one thing, but going to a must-see place and then being willing to walk 10, 20, 30 minutes down a trail and realize that at that point nobody's around and you're empty and your experience is just what it was supposed to be. It was solitude in nature. People complain about the amount of tourist buses and this and that, but in Yosemite, it's the exact same thing, right? I mean, if you are literally standing at the base of Yosemite Falls, what's going to happen? You're going to see a lot of people there. But if you are willing to get off the trail a little bit or go to, maybe a part of the park that's less visited, you will have a serene and sublime experience. And I feel like in so many ways, that is what people expect to see there, and they still can. But it's this idea that you need to go to places with the ability or with the understanding that risk is a small part of it.
Not having an exact plan.
Yes, absolutely. And that's so crucial. I think that's the message that I've really tried to put forward. And I've absolutely seen things change. I've seen people change, and I've seen, you know, the food change over there, and I've seen the glaciers change. I've seen a lot of things change. But the beauty and the connection to the land is still very much there.
You're listening to Chris Burkhart. I'm not going to go through your list of things, but clearly he's a storyteller and he has traveled the world and brought back these stories and these experiences. He's going to be sharing these experiences at a fundraiser for the Slow Classical Academy on February the 21st at the PAC. And you can go on the PAC's website to find out more about it. What's it called? Is it called An Evening with Chris Burkhardt?
Yeah, something. Photojournalism something. At the Ends of the Earth. So
photojournalism yeah, at the ends yeah. of the earth.
So you'll an evening, get to, an evening with Chris Burkhardt sounds like I'm going to be sitting in the Barca Lounge with like a little
a pipe like glass and of, telling yeah. some stories. That's yeah. what I'm picturing. Or actually. Actually, I picture you on your Peloton bike because that's your new thing.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
So along with your trips to Iceland last year, you did a race around the island that was crazy that you trained for.
It was silly. I rode.
Didn't you set a record?
I did. I raced. So every year they do an event called WOW Cyclothon. It's okay. a nonstop ride around the entire circumference of the country following Highway 1 or Route 1 as they call it. And I entered the solo division, meaning most people that do it in a relay team of 10 or 2 or 3 or 4 or however many they want. But I did the solo division. So just me out there by myself. I had a SAG team that just carried water and other things. And I pedaled my way around the country for 52 hours and 30 minutes straight. And I'll tell you what, my butt will never be the same. I hallucinated heavily. I endured the most absolute body fatigue I've ever experienced in my entire life. And I dug very, 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 very deep into a place that I never quite thought was possible. But in an effort to kind of summarize why, you know, what I've realized is that there is this sort of, in many ways, canyon of deep and emotion that sometimes you need to tap into. And I think for someone like myself, who's put up a lot of barriers and walls to sort of keep out certain people or things, it takes effort and it takes energy. And I like to think of a bicycle as moving meditation. You got to think about in a world where you can just simply grab your phone and be mesmerized and taken away adrift for hours on end, to not be able to do that at all and to not have anything other to do than to just move forward under your own power is a deeply meditative process for me. It allows me to think really intensely upon things that I care about, what I love. I mean,
it calms your monkey mind. Let's be honest.
Yes, absolutely.
you need the motion and the kineticness to kind of focus.
But in also understanding that, like, you have to move forward. Mm-hmm. So what is going to drive you to do that? At a certain point, it's your own energy. Then maybe it's food. Then maybe it's caffeine. Then maybe it's more caffeine. At a certain point, you're literally thinking of the thing that makes you the most mad in the world, and you're trying to channel that anger to push you forward, right? And then all of a sudden, you're thinking about, like, the people that you love very, very most, and their picture is just coming into your mind, and it's like you're literally bawling your eyes out. It's mile, 634. It's an 850-mile ride, basically, and you're just crying and on the road. It's like the funniest
thing. By yourself.
By yourself. And it was such a beautiful experience to just, I mean, talk about spending time thinking about what is most important to you in your life. There is absolutely nothing I've done that will ever in my life crystallize what I feel is most important than that ride.
So a decade of traveling to Iceland, and I really resonate what you talk about, feeling like you want to put roots in places, not just try to check off seeing every place in the world. I feel like I'm very much that person in my life that, you know, my husband will say, what do you want to do this year? And I always draw myself back to the same places.
You were talking about that before the show. You're like, yeah,
yes, I come every summer.
Yeah, I love that.
I'm here every summer. So when I talk to someone who has that wanderlust to keep going, I'm always fascinated because that doesn't drive me. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you notice, or because you live it, that your monkey mind, that the energy that makes you who you are, is really unique. I mean, your energy towards your purpose and your goals and your striving through your career and then setting your sights on the bike riding, I mean, that is a unique temperament that you have that not all people have.
Right. I agree.
I have a question. So I'm curious.
I'm just trying to think through like what you're saying. I'm like, that's interesting. I appreciate that a lot.
Yeah, it is unique. And I think when you kind of talk about people need to have this plan, part of it that you have that maybe you don't appreciate in others, they don't have it. Mm-hmm. That is what makes you unique. That's what makes your story interesting is that you're driven in a way that the majority of people are not. Mm-hmm. That is unique into you. So then my follow-up question is, you have two sons. Mm-hmm. And you are their role model, and you are their, depending on what kind of mood you're in. No, but you are their guide, mm-hmm. and they're not going to have your same temperament. I mean, one of the two boys might, but odds are
it's a mixture.
So how are you working with your style to be the best dad you can for the temperament of your boys at 7 and 5?
Right. And I think that's a great thing. And a question. I think that in one hand, I will never let them give up on something that they want to do. Mm-hmm. Like if they choose to do it, they will finish. I don't care if they do a terrible piss poor job, but they need to finish what they start. Okay. I think that that is one thing that I would attribute to, you know, attending Boy Scouts and just, you know, and going to church early on in my life and things like that. And just understanding that, in a team sport, especially, like, you can't let other teammates down, and you go out and you give 110%, and you can't just call it in when you're tired. But when it's yourself, what a critical thing to know too, that you don't want to let yourself down, that self-accountability is critical. That being said, I don't want my kids to necessarily do what I do. I don't want them to feel the need to be a photographer or to walk in my footsteps. I, in many ways, want to celebrate their interests, because what a cool thing, what a cool relationship, and I'm sure you've seen this, to where your daughter, Sa, you have two, mm-hmm. correct? Mm-hmm. Two, that's it, yeah. A son, too?
No.
No, son.
Three. Son-in-law.
Yeah, son-in-law. But how cool that they have something that they can share with you, and it makes you feel more equals, instead of like, if I was like, oh, well, I want my son to be a photographer, and then he's going to do what I do, and then it's always like, oh, well, dad's teaching you how to do this, and like, I'm always kind of like, you know, a step ahead, sort of. That would be a terrible thing in many ways to kind of try to live up to. And I want to find equal ground where every time I go out with them, I want them to teach me something new. And I want them to feel that joy of allowing somebody to learn from them. Like, what a gift. And that has been a big thing. And realizing too, in my mind, that we don't, and my wife has been really helpful with this, is like, you don't have to go on huge astronomical adventures to give your kids a good time. Like for us, there are little river mouths in Big Sur that we love to go to and let them swim around in, or little areas that like they can look forward to going and having a single day getaway. As where sometimes I think we overthink it a little bit, and I've been in those shoes a lot. And so that's really important to me. Maximizing time is just so, so important to urge those kids to understand. And within that, I think that, it's been a big reason why we've tried to move out onto some acreage to basically create more responsibilities for everybody. Why not? Life
more chores,
more complicated. And that's been a big vision of my wife's as well, is being able to kind of do that. So
I want to talk about Bree.
Yeah.
Because I love her so.
Okay.
And how how has her steadfastness, her solidness changed you in the decade? You know, you started off kind of pushing the boat. It's like, here, Bree, jump on. We're going to catch this train. I've got this vision. Mm-hmm. Ride along with me, honey. It's going to be a great ride.
Well, that's the funny part about the train leaving the station, is that sometimes it's you, and then sometimes you've got your hand on somebody else, and you're bringing them along with
you. Yeah. And so at some point now, with the two sons, I'm curious to know how your relationship with Bree has grown and changed and brought you to where you are today, 10 years down the path.
We have become better communicators,
okay,
for sure. One of the things that just I wish she was here right now, because I tell you what, the thing that I get asked so often is just, how do you manage these relationships, mm-hmm. when, you know, somebody's away from the home, or you're spending your time, or you have this big creative vision, and in the reality is like, it's not easy. It takes time, but we've been doing this for we've been married for over 10 years, you know, like it takes time to work it out. So I don't really know how to answer that for somebody who's like, I'm in, you know, month 6 of marriage. Like, maybe just start with good communication and build that foundation. We've realized for us, like, texting is not a great form of communication. You need to hear someone's voice. You need to hear the tone of someone's voice when they say, I'm okay, mm-hmm. versus I'm okay. You know, it's a very different thing. The biggest eye opener for me has been realizing that if I come home from this transformative, life-changing, just mind-bending experience where I was in remote Russia and this, you know, frozen lake, and I saw the northern lights. I don't know. Oh my gosh, Bree, like, you know, you need to, I'm on cloud nine. You need to come up to my level. That's not going to happen. In fact, coming home and trying to match that energy is impossible. Mm-hmm. They could have been your significant other, whomever it is, could have been in the doldrums of diapers and daily life and homeschool and taxes and this and that. So to understand that you need to do everything in your power to give them the opportunity to find that same growth is critical. I cannot think of anything more important than to be like, how can I support you in finding your thing, whatever that is? And if it's nothing, then that's a scary situation to be in. Find the help them find that thing. And I don't think this needs to be a situation where it's just the man leaving the home and the woman's back. I mean, it can be vice versa, whatever that looks like for you. For Bree, a big portion of that is supporting her doing horse therapy coaching and, mm-hmm. and training, because she really wants to use that as an amazing tool to go out and help people. And so, you know, whether it's watching the kids, whether it's, you know, going out with her, whether it's me being a test subject, whether it's going and riding horses, which I'm terrified of, but it allows me to kind of be in that situation where she can come back and be like, oh my gosh, babe, you should have seen this thing. And I just, that creates so much joy for me.
To both be able to find that elevated space. And I think part of the work is to be able to come in and fall back into the routine of the mundane, which is really what life is all about. Because the peak experiences are momentary. Mm. You know, they're peak moments.
Right.
But the day-to-day, the mundane of raising your family, being able to find yourself back to that space, I think really is the art.
And it's so true.
And really, I think if you're bringing something to the world with your gift of as a family, it's how you make that work in the day to day and keep the family first. And I hope that this is just like the next conversation before the next conversation where we find out where this relationship has taken you, the boys. Chris Burkhardt has been my guest today. The fundraiser is called
Photojournalism at the Ends of the Earth.
Check out the PACS website or go to chrisburkhardt.com.
Yep, exactly.
To find out more information, you can find out information by checking out The Reluctant Therapist either on Instagram or Facebook. Send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to this show. It'll be posted soon. As always, thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Chris, thanks for coming in today.
Dark girl, I-